it is not exactly as she was picturing, the house where her father once lived. But she remembers it, or feels like she does. She puts the car back in gear and turns off the main road, bumping down the gravel drive toward it. Billy parks, and Rufus pops up in the back, his head veering between the driver and passenger seats, nosing her arm. Her hands stretch across the top of the wheel, palms thick and tingling from the long drive. She gets out and opens the back door. The dog bounds to the front porch, sniffs, and pees on the corner of the battered wooden steps. "Thanks," she says, as he gallops across the overgrown yard. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm talking to Chanel Benz, author of The Gone Dead. Billy's mother was a white freedom writer, and her father a well-known black poet from Mississippi. At 34, Billy inherits her grandmother's house where her father once lived. She hasn't been back in 30 years, and has no recollection of the accident that took her father's life. But there are people in the small Delta town who want to make sure she never learns the truth. I'm grateful to Chanel for doing this recording, even though, in order to have quiet, she has to sit in her car on a sweltering July day because we're in the middle of a global pandemic and her children are home now. There's no camp or summer activities. Hi, Chanel. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Galit. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, how did you come to write this incredible novel?
Well, I was looking for an idea big enough that would last for a novel. I had written a short story collection before this, and I was primarily writing short stories, although I didn't start out that way. And it wasn't until I was driving, I was living in Mississippi with my husband in a town called Hattiesburg, which is actually southeast Mississippi, or southwest. And there's not a whole lot to do there. So I started just getting in my car and driving to any sort of notable or historical spots. And I started driving into the Mississippi Delta. And as I started looking at different landmarks and just looking at the landscape in general, I started doing some different searches and research and finding out about the history. And I stumbled upon some civil rights era cold cases. And there are just these long lists of names, and I focused mainly on Mississippi. And I just never heard of all of these people who had been murdered in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and hadn't got any kind of justice. Some of them were on these really beta sort of websites that somebody had obviously made as a kind of labor of love, you know, when the internet first came out. And it would just have a sentence about men and women and children in some cases. And as I found, you know, different FBI records, it was pretty obvious about who the perpetrators were. And there are a couple journalists who actually have helped bring these cases forward, and there's been a few indictments. But it's only been through these journalists in a kind of communal effort. But I felt like these stories and these kinds of histories were very much in the air in the Delta and are obviously still recurring in our country today. And so I wanted to write about one of these lost stories.
So interesting. There's a lot of really wonderful characters. Let's start by talking about Billie James. What's going on with her? And why does she buy a gun even though she has no idea how to use it?
So she, her grandmother dies, her maternal grandmother. And what's happened is her father was a civil rights activist and he was also a black arts poet in the 60s, early 70s. And so he had a small piece of land in the Delta that when he passed in 72, it went to her mother. And then when her mother died, when she was, oh gosh, I think in her sophomore year of college, it went to her grandmother and then eventually passed to her. So now this small piece of land that her father's family has owned has come to her. And so she's decided to go and check it out and see if any of her family's still there. But she hasn't been there since her father was alive and he passed when she was four. So when she goes out there, it's in the Mississippi Delta, which is a really lush but desolate landscape. You know, it's some of the richest soil. I can't remember exactly, but I think it even is similar to the Nile. It's some of the richest soil in the world. And So it has this lush greenness and these different rivers running through it, but there's almost no population there. And it's also a very poverty-stricken area. So a lot of the old buildings and general stores are still there, although they're sort of like crumbling into the earth. And, you know, the Mississippi Delta is known for the Delta Blues. It's known for the Freedom Riders, for the Civil Rights Movement, for people like Medgar Evers, Fannie Lou Hamer, the blues musician Robert Johnson. And so it has this deep sort of, you know, it carries a legacy of slavery and sharecropping. And in a way, it never feels to me like it's 2020 there, or even 2019. It always feels like it's a different era and a different time. And it's a very rural landscape. And so this is very foreign for her she's coming from Philadelphia. And so she's in this old sort of shack, tenant shack that her father owned. And she brings a gun, I think because she calls her uncle, which is her father's younger brother, and he's kind of told her, like, you're going to need a dog and a gun. And she happens to have inherited a dog, so she's got the dog. And I think she just kind of brings the gun because she's going to be a woman alone. And I think she feels like she's a relatively capable person. And so, of course, she'll just learn how to shoot it and be just fine. But I think it's something she does on a little bit of a whim. Mm. But, and I think also just to make herself feel safer out there alone.
Well, we just know if there's a gun in the first act, what's going to happen. Yeah. So,
yeah. And I also just feel that, you know, it was also a kind of nod to the idea of, like, as a woman, you can never go anywhere freely. Mm. That you always have to have that awareness. Like, you can't just go in the woods for a hike. Mm-hmm. And so I just felt like she can't just come to this place. She knows that. And so she's kind of, you know, haplessly arming herself.
Why is the uncle the only family member with whom she has kept contact?
Well, her grandmother's passed, and that was her father's only sibling, really. And so I think a lot of the family has died out, but she was there till she was four. And her mother never kept up that contact. So I feel like, you know, the child often, if the parents are separated, more often than not goes with the mother. And if the mother doesn't, you know, keep up contact with the father's family, that sort of dies off. And so they're basically, you know, strangers to her. She has a few, you know, childhood memories with them, but they're living very different lives in the Delta. And, you know, even her contact with her uncle is, they've barely spoken.
Right. One of her cousins comes down from Memphis, right? What's mm-hmm. Lola's relationship with Billy? And let's discuss the college debt situation for Lola and others.
Yeah, so they share a grandmother. So they are cousins, but I think they're sort of like second cousins. And but they played together as kids. So they have those kind of, you know, when you play together and your favorite cousin, you just have that kind of warm bond of understanding with them. So when they reconnect, it just kind of comes back without them having to really do much work. It's just sort of like they pick up where they left off. But Lola is a lot savvier than Billy. You know, she's living in Memphis, so she's living in the city, but she comes down to the Delta all the time. And she kind of has a love, I don't know if I'd say love, hate, but she has a love relationship with it, but also she's very well aware of its flaws and the sort of darkness that's there. And she's trying to live her life, but she's struggling because of debt. And I just, you know, when I was first trying to write the story, I wrote it in first person, I wrote it in second, I wrote it in third. And for a long time, it was just Billy and then her father's voice. And at one point, it was her mother's voice. And it wasn't until I realized that I needed to understand Billy by understanding the community that was surrounding her, that it wasn't just her story, that it was a story of these two families of this town, that it was a communal story, so that I needed multiple voices. So when I started thinking, well, which of these characters that I've created are going to speak, Lola is somebody that, in a kind of sort of hostile environment, is a friend, is a confidant, and is someone who's sort of grounded and rooted. But Lola needed to have her own struggles. She needed not just to be a plot device for Billy. And so when I thought about what it would mean for a young Black woman trying to make her way in the South, I thought about, having taught in the South, college debt, and how it is this thing that keeps the younger generation, and even those of us who aren't so young anymore, from buying a house, from purchasing a car, from having a family, because you're paying, you know, you might have a six-figure amount that you're paying $500 a week. So money that would be going elsewhere, you just don't have. So you don't get to travel as much. And you just sort of feel this constant burden, and most, usually you're just paying off the interest. And so I wanted to sort of portray the nagging debt of that, the nagging weight of that, and how it really shrinks the landscape of what's possible for you, of what kind of life you're gonna live. Makes you feel like what things you've actually accomplished are not much at all. And that you've maybe made mistakes somewhere along the way. So I think, you know, now it's entered more of a national conversation, but especially the novel takes place in 2003. That really wasn't part of the national conversation, that there are so many students and so many people struggling with this debt. It's really getting in the way of them living freely. And I also think when we talk about things like equity, and, you know, there's been a lot of posts, I think it was it Bill Gates? No, it was Jeff Bezos. You know, it's an anniversary of Amazon or something like that, or he invented it in his garage. And a lot of people have countered that by saying, well, when Amazon was failing in, I don't know, 1999, his parents gave him $250,000 loan, you know, and the garage that he was, you know, doing his first startup business in what is like a beautiful little spot. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have a garage. And so, you know, kind of getting rid of those mythology of the bootstraps, like if you just work hard enough, and this kind of like punitive attitude, and especially for people that didn't come from wealth or inherited wealth, or, you know, had that sort of leg up, or maybe didn't even have the support of their family to go to college, but they went ahead and did it. It, you know, getting rid of that means that it no longer feels like a punishment that you made choices to get an education. And for some people, they were preyed upon. You know, there's a lot of predatory lending.
Yeah, and one community was affected more than other communities in the United States.
Exactly.
Actually, you brought up something really interesting about, I think it was Billy's grandfather who returns from fighting in Europe during World War II. I was wondering, how was it legal for him to be denied access to the GI Bill?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know exactly. I think there was just, I can't remember exactly my research, but there's so many ways, you know, with like redlining and different districting, and there's so many ways in which Black folks in this country have been historically, recently historically disenfranchised. But yeah, I think when we think of, you know, boomers kind of benefiting from that wealth or that kind of boom in the economy, a lot of it was people benefiting from the GI Bill, but Black community didn't benefit from it because most of them were denied a GI Bill. Like it's a tiny, tiny amount. So that access to, and even, you know, even if they did get the GI Bill for education, they had to choose a Black college. And at the time, there would only be so many, like if you wanted to be a lawyer, well, there's in your state, there's only going to be so many Black law schools. And I think that was one of the first times that somebody tried to get into the University of Mississippi, is because there wasn't another law program. Because colleges were still segregated. So yeah, I think one thing that is not common knowledge is how difficult it was for World War I and World War II Black veterans. Not only had they had this taste of, you know, overseas, getting to travel, having new experiences, but also, and fighting for their country, but also getting to feel like what it was to be treated with more equality, what it was to be treated more like not a second-class citizen in Europe and elsewhere. And so when they came back, they felt like they're expecting more, right? They're expecting to sort of have some pride, be repaid, that the relationship with white people in the country is going to be different. But not only are they not going to get the same benefits, and not only are they not going to sort of rise in the ranks, that there's actually going to be some intense hostility, because the idea of black men coming back for more trained and armed is frightening to some people in the white community. And so there will always be, not always, but there is always an uptick in violence, in lynching, every time black veterans return from war.
Horrifying. Can you talk about what Lola means when she tells Billy that the movement broke a lot of people?
Yeah, so that's one of those things that I didn't know until I started teaching about the Mississippi Delta, about the writers there. And there's a book I teach called Coming of Age in Mississippi by this writer, Ann Moody, and it's a memoir. And it's basically about her coming of age as a teenager in as a young kid in Mississippi. It starts at like age 4, and her parents are basically sharecroppers, and she is basically babysitting her 2-year-old brother or sister. And so it goes through her sort of coming of age, and she eventually joins the movement. And at one point, her family is being threatened, and she's very torn about whether she should keep, you know, working with in the freedom schools, or, you know, stop so that her family's safe. And so it's really interesting. And one thing that she sort of talks about, and actually happened to her, is there was a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder coming from people's experiences from the movement, and especially people who were heavily involved or leaders, you know, those who we know their names and those who we don't. Because you were in situations where you were staying in a hostile town, trying to register black people to vote and trying to teach them, you know, the state constitution or whatever you had to do, whatever tests they had to pass at the courthouse. And you were in some kind of safe house, quote unquote, which at night everybody would sleep on the floor, so that, because sometimes the windows would get shot out, or maybe dynamite or a bomb would be thrown in. You could be walking down the street and a car full of young men could come by, and it could be Klan members. And the police force were often involved in the Klan, or they were definitely sympathetic 99% of the time. So, you know, and you have things like, you know, Mississippi Burning. So there was a lot of tension and pressure that, you know, something could happen to you deep in the night or even in the middle of the day. And a lot of people came out of the movement. And like Ann Moody, she had this amazing book, and she just never really wrote again after that. And so there's a lot of people where they just sort of, you wonder what happened to them. And just some of them, they just never got over the trauma that they went through.
Just to clarify, you're talking about the civil rights movement, for anybody listening who didn't hear that. Okay.
Yeah. And so it's interesting this time around with these protests and, you know, different people working on different sort of activism, that there's a lot of talk about self-care. And although that's a kind of buzzword that I don't particularly care for, I'm really glad that people are talking about it, because it's acknowledging that it's really exhausting to deal with people who are violently opposed to everybody having equality, or, you know, whatever sort of thing, agenda you're sort of pushing forward for equality, or to get awareness about Black Lives Matter, or accountability for a murder. And yeah, it can be really exhausting on multiple levels, not just for strangers, but there can be people in your life that you know who, you know, are really resistant. And so just kind of acknowledging the emotional labor that goes into that has been really amazing to see.
Mm. Tell us about Billy's father and mother and why they got married in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so Billy's father was a civil rights era activist, and he was also a Black Arts Movement poet. And the Black Arts Movement it was sort of the artistic movement, the artistic arm of the Black Power movement. And it was basically saying for the first time, I always think of the James Brown song, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And it was the first time that Black artists were celebratory about being Black. You know, they weren't trying to be a certain kind of Black or exceptional or, you know, playing to a white audience. They were writing for themselves and writing for their community and, you know, thinking about their roots and where they came from and not being ashamed of being enslaved, and really celebrating resistance and their stories and all those things. And so that's what the Black Arts Movement was really about. And her mother ended up being, she was a civil rights activist too. They were both freedom riders. So they were trying to integrate the federal buses system. So Greyhound, basically. And they met and worked in the movement, you know, very young, 21 years old. And I did see a lot of relationships between Black people and white people. And a lot of times they would get married, but more often than not, these relationships would not last. And I think it was really interesting because you would have in these freedom schools and freedom houses where they were all staying as, like, you know, young 20s, some even like 19, you know, coming out of college, a lot of them dropped out to be part of the movement, where they had never shook hands with a white person or a Black person, let alone, you know, shared a room. So you have a lot of these like deep sort of intense friendships and relationships. But then, you know, after the movement, after the this kind of excitement and terror, they have to face the world. So their relationship didn't last very long, and they did have a child, but they quickly divorced. And I think it was mostly his idea, because I think there was some guilt about marrying a white woman and not a Black woman, because he was inside of this movement that was about Black celebration, that was about not being ashamed or, you know. And so she goes on to become a medieval scholar, a medievalist. And partly that's because of my own fascination with the medieval era.
Ah, okay.
But because I also felt that there was resonance. And so I felt like there is, in the medieval era, you have the feudal system, you do have serfs, but even beyond serfs, just the peasant class, which is 99% of what most of us would be. We always think, like, picture ourselves as some noble person, but most of us would have been peasants, that your bodies were connected to the land, that you really weren't allowed to move around a lot. There was a lot of vagrancy laws, and you really lived and died in the same, you know, small patch of earth.
Yeah, they were killing my people at that point. So yeah, those weren't good years. Billy visits Jerry Hobson, whose wife died recently. How are they connected to Billy's family?
So Billy hears that Jerry Hobson's wife, was one of her father's close friends, and she's just interested to find out more information about her father. And so she goes to visit him, and internally he is not wanting to talk about the past. She really wants to talk about her father's death, which she knows very little about. She was there. He died one night in 1972, when she was about 4, and she was in the house. And it's always been told to her that it was an accident, that he fell in the woods and he hit his head and he died. But she definitely wants to know more. And I think for me, it was one of those stories that you've been told so many times that you just accept it as the truth until you start to maybe tell other people or sort of re-examine it and realize there's all these missing threads. And in fact, it doesn't make sense. And you kind of start rooting around for what the real story is, which sometimes becomes difficult, or it becomes difficult, especially when you're older, to find the truth keepers. So this is what she's trying to do. And he brings up the fact that she went missing that night, which is not something she knows. about that
right.
time.
Let's talk briefly about the McGee family.
Sure.
Are they good people?
Well, so the McGees are often, there would be a sort of plantation farm owning family, white family. And at some point in history, they would have a lot of sharecroppers, or they would have a lot of people that worked the farm, but also lived on the farm in tenant shacks. And, you know, sometimes there would be upwards of 1,000 people living on a plantation. And so her family was one of these families on a plantation living in these tenant shacks that was owned by the McGees. But they were closer to the McGee's home. Her grandmother worked for the McGees as a domestic servant. And so her family is very intertwined with them. And they are now, because most of the tenant shacks have been knocked down, they are now her closest neighbor. So somebody that she's bound to talk to. But Black families that were really close to white families, and still are, when I've talked to people in the Delta, there still are these kind of entanglements. They are sometimes called shadow families, because your grandmother feels to them like their grandmother because they've been raised by her. You know, so there's a lot of this entanglement, but still, you know, your grandmother might be using the back door, or it might be hard for your uncles to look that white family in the eye. So a lot of the vestiges of the Jim Crow era are still present, and there's still a sense, there's still, you know, massive wealth inequality. So the McGees are this family, and I wanted to get into something that I think is not as present outside of the South, but definitely present in the Deep South, definitely present in Mississippi and the Delta, that you have these families where, you know, there's definitely inequality happening. There's definitely racism happening, but there's also a lot of love. And I wanted to kind of, I talked to a lot of older men from the Delta who would tell me stories of their childhood best friends who were Black or white, who when they, you know, became teenagers, they were told they were no longer allowed to play with. And so Cliff, her father, and Mr. McGee, Jim McGee, were childhood playmates. But once they, you know, grew up, their lives went in very different directions. And, you know, although I think it's sometimes more interesting to talk less or focus less on the kind of mustache twiddling villains and focus on the people who are more apt to be silent and complicit. Mm-hmm. You know, MLK's the white moderate. So the people who are involved, who are standing kind of on the sidelines. And so I wanted to get into those things using the McGee family.
Yeah, it was complex. There's one more character that I absolutely loved, the bumbling, brilliant Dr. Melvin Hurley, who spends every minute of his time trying not to smoke.
Yeah. He was really fun to create. I wanted to have different versions of Blackness. And so I wanted Black academia to be represented. And I sort of, one of the characters I was thinking about for Cliff was this poet, Henry Dumas. And Henry Dumas had some short stories and some poetry published, I think, in like a few university journals, but he never had a book published in his own lifetime. It was only after he died that Toni Morrison, while she was an editor at Random House, published some of his books and hails him as a genius. But he was this kind of a Black arts poet, but very much on the fringe, not really known. And he was mysteriously shot and killed in Harlem by a white police officer in a subway station. And the details around his death, they're sort of a bit hazy. But I conceive the doctor as somebody who has really found their person in Cliff and really wants to sort of make their name by being a Cliff James scholar, but has never been able to have any success whatsoever. And so he was a character that also can talk about some of the academic accomplishments that Cliff had done in the era. And it made sense that he would be sort of contextualizing the Black Arts Movement and the different poems and, you know, sort of concentrating on that in a way that nobody else is realistically going to be talking about it. But I also felt like Billy needed some kind of ally.
Okay, well, if you write another book about any of these people, could he please get tenure and and just be really successful? And then can we also have Billy really happy?
Aww.
So, okay. Last question. I don't think this gives anything away, but near the end of the book, why did you choose to reference King Henry II of England? How does that fit into your way of thinking?
Yeah, so like I said, the medieval kind of allusions, I thought that Billy would be thinking of them since her mother was a medievalist. And I think that they lived in the medieval era, they lived a much more physical life. You know, they dealt with death. They dealt with the body in a way that we don't, in a way that death has been sanitized and sort of removed literally away from our hands. You know, the body doesn't come into our hands. We don't wash and prepare our loved ones. They don't lay in our living rooms. And so I think it's much more frightening. And then they also, you know, were mostly rooted in religion, perhaps more than we are, or it was more central. But I also think with this physicality, that words were much more physical, especially because were so many people who were illiterate, but that words were a lot more powerful. And so something that a king can just mutter and be overheard can set in motion all of these complex happenings, can cause violence. And I think right now there's been a lot of downplaying when different people who have different platforms or politicians or, you know, even people who are quote unquote influencers say things that incite violence, say things that are racist or misogynistic, that actually can do harm, and not just emotional harm, but that actually can move people to violence or move people to not wear masks or take a medicine that they shouldn't be taking, that actually can cause harm, that actually can spill blood. And so I wanted to kind of say that, you know, words do matter. They are this physical thing. They are something that physically shapes us. That the things we're told, that the stories we hear shape who we are, how we breathe, how we walk, how we move through the world.
I've just been nodding the entire time you've been talking through this whole interview. So I'd like to know what you're working on next.
I've been doing some research on the yellow fever epidemic of 1878 in Memphis. And since I'm here in Memphis, and I've been doing a lot of, I've been uncovering some really, really interesting things about that time. So I'm thinking I'm definitely going to write something on it. I'm not sure if it's going to be a novel or a shorter piece, but we'll see. It's not easy to do without childcare.
Oh, yeah, but pandemics are hot right now. So.
I know. I actually started the idea before the pandemic. So.
Okay. Chanel, it was so lovely talking to you. This is always a wonderful conversation, and I wish you the best of luck. I know your book just was reissued in paperback this year, came out last year. It was new to me. It was a New York Times 100 notable books of 2019, and I think it should also be a notable book of 2020. A notable paperback. How about that? Okay. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I've been talking with Chanel Benz, author of The Gone Dead. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Book Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to Shuffle, www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.